Reading from The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson, Chapter 4, Galvanized. In his first 24 hours in office, Churchill revealed himself to be a very different kind of prime minister, where Chamberlain, the old umbrella, the coroner, was staid and deliberate. The new prime minister, true to his reputation, was flamboyant, electric, and wholly unpredictable. One of Churchill's first acts was to appoint himself Minister of Defense, which prompted an outgoing official to write in his diary, "Heaven help us." The post was a new one, through which Churchill would oversee the chiefs of staff who controlled the Army, Navy, and Air Force. He now had full control of the war and full responsibility. He moved quickly to build his government, making 7 key appointments by noon the next day. He kept Lord Halifax as Foreign Secretary and, in an act of generosity and loyalty, also included Chamberlain, naming him Lord President of the Council, a post with a minimal workload, which served as a bridge between the government and the King. Rather than evict Chamberlain immediately from the Prime Ministerial residence at No. 10 Downing Street, Churchill resolved to continue living for a while at Admiralty House, his current home, to give Chamberlain time for a dignified exit. He offered Chamberlain an adjacent townhouse, No. 11 Downing, which Chamberlain had occupied in the 1930s while Chancellor of the Exchequer. A new electricity surged through Whitehall. Subdued corridors awoke. It was as though the machine had overnight acquired 1 or 2 new gears, capable of far higher speeds than had ever before been thought possible, wrote Edward Bridges, Secretary to the War Cabinet. This new energy, unfamiliar and disconcerting, coursed through all bureaucratic strata, from the lowest secretary to the most senior minister. The effect within No. 10 was galvanic. Under Chamberlain, even the advent of war had not altered the pace of work, according to John Colville. But Churchill was a dynamo. To Colville's astonishment, respectable civil servants were actually to be seen running along the corridors. For Colville and his fellow members of Churchill's private secretariat, the workload increased to hitherto unimagined levels. Churchill issued directives and commands in brief memoranda known as minutes, which he dictated to a typist, one of whom was always on hand from the moment he awoke until he went to bed. He raged at misspellings and nonsensical phrases caused by what he deemed to be misattention, although, in fact, the challenge of taking dictation from him was made all the harder by a slight lisp-like speech impediment that caused him to muddy his S's. In the course of transcribing a 27-page speech, one typist, Elizabeth Layton, who came to 10 Downing in 1941, drew his ire for making a single error, typing "air minister" instead of "air ministry," thereby creating a sentence with an unintended but robust visual image. The air minister was in a state of chaos from top to bottom. It could be hard to hear Churchill, however, especially in the morning when he dictated from bed, according to Layton. Other clarity-distorting factors intruded as well. "There's always that cigar," she remarked, "and usually he paces up and down the room as he dictates, so that sometimes he's behind your chair and sometimes far across the room." No detail was too small to draw his attention, even the phrasing and grammar that ministers used when writing their reports. They were not to use the word aerodrome, but rather airfield. Not aeroplane, but aircraft. Churchill was particularly insistent that ministers compose memoranda with brevity and limit their length to 1 page or less. "It is slothful not to compress your thoughts," he said. Such precise and demanding communication installed at all levels a new sense of responsibility for events and dispelled the fustiness of routine ministerial work. Churchill's communiques tumbled forth daily, by the dozens, invariably brief, and always written in precise English. It was not uncommon for him to demand an answer on a complex subject before the day was out. Anything that was not of immediate importance and a concern to him was of no value, wrote General Alan Brooke, known as Brookie, to the secretarial staff at No. 10 Downing Street. When he wanted something done, everything else had to be dropped. The effect, Brooke observed, was like the beam of a searchlight ceaselessly swinging round and penetrating into the remote recesses of the administration, so that everyone, however humble his task or his function, felt that one day the beam might rest on him and light up what he was doing. Pending Chamberlain's departure from No. 10 Downing, Churchill established an office on the ground floor of Admiralty House, where he planned to work at night. A typist and a private secretary occupied the dining room and daily traversed a walkway populated with furniture in a dolphin motif, the backs and arms of chairs rendered in kelp and twisty marine creatures. Churchill's office occupied an inner room. On his desk he kept a miscellany of pills, powders, and toothpicks, as well as cuffs to protect his sleeves, and various gold medals, which he deployed as paperweights. Bottles of whiskey stood on an adjacent table. By day, he occupied an office at 10 Downing. But Churchill's notion of what constituted an office was expansive. Often, generals, ministers, and staff members would find themselves meeting with Churchill while he was in the bathtub, one of his favorite places to work. He also liked working in bed, and spent hours there each morning going through dispatches and reports with typist seated nearby. Always present was the box, a black dispatch box that contained reports, correspondence, and minutes from other officials requiring his attention, replenished daily by his private secretaries. Nearly every morning, one visitor in particular came to Churchill's bedroom, Major General Hastings Ismay, newly appointed military chief of staff, known lovingly and universally as Pug, for his likeness to that breed of dog. It was Ismay's job to serve as an intermediary between Churchill and the chiefs of the three military services, helping them to understand him and him to understand them. Ismay did so with tact and a diplomat's grace. Immediately, he became one of the central members of what Churchill called his secret circle. Ismay came to Churchill's bedroom to discuss matters that would come up later at the morning meeting of the chiefs of staff. Other times, he would simply sit with Churchill in case he was needed, a warm and calming presence. Pug was a favorite of typists and private secretaries alike. The eyes, wrinkling nose, mouth, and shape of his face produced a canine effect which was entirely delightful, wrote John Colville. When he smiled, his face was alight, and he gave the impression that he was wagging an easily imaginable tail. Ismay was struck by how much the public seemed to need this new prime minister. While walking with him from 10 Downing back to Admiralty House, Ismay marveled at the enthusiastic greeting Churchill got from the men and women they passed. A group of people, waiting at the private entrance to No. 10, offered their congratulations and encouragement with cries of, "Good luck, Winnie! God bless you!" Churchill was deeply moved, Ismay saw. Upon entering the building, Churchill, never afraid to express emotion, began to weep. "Poor people, poor people," he said. "They trust me, and I can give them nothing but disaster for quite a long time." What he wanted most to give them was action, as he made clear from the start, action in all realms, from the office to the battlefield. What he especially wanted was for Britain to take the offensive in the war, to do something, anything, to bring the war directly to that bad man, his preferred term for Adolf Hitler. As Churchill said on frequent occasions, he wanted Germans to bleed and burn. Within 2 days of his taking office, 37 RAF bombers attacked the German city of Mönchengladbach in Germany's heavily industrialized Ruhr district. The raid killed 4 people, one of whom, oddly enough, was an English woman. But mere mayhem wasn't the point. This mission, and other raids soon to follow, were meant to signal to the British public, to Hitler, and especially to the United States, that Britain intended to fight. The same message that Churchill sought to convey on Monday, May 13, when he gave his first speech before the House of Commons. He spoke with confidence, vowing to achieve victory, but also as a realist who understood the bleak terrain in which Britain now lay. One line stood out with particular clarity. "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat." Although later these words would take their place in the pantheon of oratory as among the finest ever spoken, and years later would even receive praise from Hitler's chief propagandist, Joseph Goebbels, at the time the speech was just another speech, delivered to an audience made newly skeptical by mourning after remorse. John Colville, who, despite his new assignment, remained loyal to Chamberlain, dismissed it as a brilliant little speech. For the occasion, Colville chose to wear a bright blue new suit from the 50-shilling tailors, a large chain of shops that sold low-cost men's clothing, cheap and sensational-looking, which I felt was appropriate to the new government. By now, German forces were asserting their hold on the Low Countries with ruthless authority. On May 14, massed bombers of the Luftwaffe, flying at 2,000 feet, bombed Rotterdam in what appeared to be an indiscriminate assault, leaving more than 800 civilians dead, and in the process signaling that a similar fate might be ahead for England. What most alarmed Churchill and his commanders, however, was the startling force with which German armor, accompanied by aircraft acting as aerial artillery, were pummeling Allied forces in Belgium and France, causing French resistance to wither and leaving Britain's Continental Army, the British Expeditionary Force, or BEF, dangerously exposed. On Tuesday, May 14, the French Prime Minister, Paul Reynaud, telephoned Churchill and begged him to send 10 squadrons of RAF fighters to supplement the 4 already promised, if possible, today. Germany was already claiming triumph. In Berlin that Tuesday, William Scheirer, an American correspondent, heard German newscasters declare victory over and over, interrupting the regular radio programming to crow about the latest advance. First would come a fanfare, then news of the latest success, and after this, as Scheirer recorded in his diary, a chorus would sing the current hit, "We March on England." At 7:30 the next morning, Wednesday, May 15, Reynaud called Churchill again, reaching him while he was still in bed. Churchill picked up the phone on his bedside table. Through the scratchy, distant connection, he heard Reynaud say in English, "We have been defeated." Churchill said nothing. "We are beaten," Reynaud said. "We have lost the battle." "Surely it can't have happened so soon," Churchill said. Reynaud told him that the Germans had broken the French line in the commune of Sedan in the Ardennes, near the French border with Belgium, and that tanks and armored cars were pouring through the gap. Churchill tried to calm his French counterpart, pointing out that military experience taught that offensives invariably lose momentum over time. "We are defeated," Reynaud insisted. This seemed so unlikely as to defy belief. The French army was large and skilled, the fortified Maginot Line said to be impregnable. British strategic planning counted on France as a partner without which the BEF had no chance of prevailing. It struck Churchill that the time had come to make a direct plea for American assistance. In a secret cable to President Roosevelt, dispatched that day, he told the president that he fully expected England to be attacked and soon, and that he was preparing for the onslaught. If necessary, we shall continue the war alone, and we are not afraid of that, he wrote. But I trust you realize, Mr. President, that the voice and force of the United States may count for nothing if they are withheld too long. You may have a completely subjugated, Nazified Europe established with astonishing swiftness, and the weight may be more than we can bear. He wanted material aid, and specifically asked Roosevelt to consider dispatching up to 50 old destroyers, which the Royal Navy would use until its own naval construction program could begin delivering new ships. He also requested aircraft, several hundred of the latest types, and anti-aircraft weapons and ammunition, of which, again, there will be plenty next year if we are alive to see it. Now he came to what he knew to be an especially sensitive matter in dealing with America, given its apparent need always to drive a hard bargain, or, at least, to be seen as doing so. "We shall go on paying dollars for as long as we can," he wrote, "but I should like to feel reasonably sure that when we can pay no more, you will give us the stuff all the same." Roosevelt replied 2 days later, stating that he could not send destroyers without the specific approval of Congress, and adding, "I am not certain that it would be wise for that suggestion to be made to the Congress at this moment." He was still wary of Churchill, but even more wary of how the American public would react. At the time, he was mulling whether to run for a third term, though he had yet to declare his interest. After sidestepping Churchill's various requests, the president added, "The best of luck to you." Ever restless, Churchill decided that he needed to meet personally with French leaders, both to better understand the battle underway and to attempt to bolster their resolve. Despite the presence of German fighters in the skies over France, on Thursday, May 16 at 3 p.m., Churchill took off in a military passenger aircraft, a de Havilland Flamingo, from an RAF airbase in Hendon, roughly 7 miles north of 10 Downing Street. This was Churchill's favorite aircraft, an all-metal, twin-engine passenger plane furnished with large upholstered armchairs. The Flamingo promptly joined a formation of Spitfires dispatched to escort it to France. Pug Ismay and a small group of other officials went along. Upon landing, they realized immediately that things were much worse than they had expected. Officers assigned to meet them told Ismay that they expected the Germans to arrive in Paris within the next few days. Wrote Ismay, "None of us could believe it." Renault and his generals again pleaded for more aircraft. After much agonizing and with an eye, as always, on history, Churchill promised the 10 squadrons. He telegraphed his war cabinet that night. It would not be good historically if their requests were denied and their ruin resulted. He and his party returned to London the next morning. The prospect of sending so many fighters to France worried Private Secretary Colville. In his diary he wrote, "This means denuding this country of a quarter of its first-line fighter defense." As the situation in France degraded, so rose the fear that Hitler would now turn his full attention to Britain. Invasion seemed a certainty. The deep current of appeasement that had persistently flowed within Whitehall and English society began to surface anew, with fresh calls for a peace arrangement with Hitler, the old instinct burbling up like groundwater through a lawn. In the Churchill household, such defeatist talk inspired only rage. One afternoon, Churchill invited David Margeson, his chief whip in Parliament, for lunch, along with Clementine and daughter Mary. Margeson was one of the so-called Men of Munich, who had previously endorsed appeasement and had supported Chamberlain's 1938 Munich Agreement. As lunch progressed, Clementine found herself growing more and more unsettled. Ever since Churchill's appointment as Prime Minister, she had become his ever-present ally, hosting luncheons and dinners and answering innumerable letters from the public. She often wore a headscarf wrapped turban-style that was printed with tiny copies of war posters and slogans exhorting "Lend to defend," "Go to it," and the like. She was now 55 years old and had been married to Churchill for 32 of them. Upon their engagement, Churchill's good friend Violet Bonham Carter had expressed grave doubts about Clementine's worthiness, forecasting that she could never be more to him than an ornamental sideboard, as I have often said, and she is unexacting enough not to mind not being more. Clementine, however, proved to be anything but a sideboard. Tall, lean, and displaying a finished, flawless beauty, as Bonham Carter conceded. She was strong-willed and independent, to the point where she often took vacations alone, absent from the family for long periods. In 1935, she traveled solo on an excursion to the Far East that lasted more than 4 months. She and Churchill kept separate bedrooms. Sex happened only upon her explicit invitation. It was to Bonham Carter that Clementine, soon after being wed, revealed Churchill's peculiar taste in underclothes, pale pink and made of silk. Clementine was undaunted by argument, no matter how lofty her opponent, and she was said to be the only person who could effectively stand up to Churchill. Now, over lunch, her anger rose. Margeson espoused a pacifism that she found repulsive. She quickly reached a point where she could stand it no longer and lit into him for his past role as an appeaser, implicitly blaming him for helping bring Britain to its current dire position. As daughter Mary put it, she flayed him verbally before sweeping out. This was not uncommon. Family members talked of Mama's sweeps. Churchill, describing one incident in which the victim received a particularly vivid rebuke, quipped, "Clementine dropped on him like a jaguar out of a tree." In this case, she did not sweep out alone. She dragged Mary with her. They had lunch at the Grill in the nearby Carlton Hotel, famous for its gleaming interior, rendered in gold and white. Mary was mortified by her mother's behavior. "I was most ashamed and horrified," she wrote in her diary. "Mummy and I had to go and have lunch at the Carlton. Good food wrecked by gloom." A visit to church presented Clementine with another opportunity to express her indignation. On Sunday, May 19, she attended a service at St. Martin in the Fields, the famed Anglican church in Trafalgar Square, and there heard a minister deliver a sermon that struck her as being inappropriately defeatist. She stood up and stormed from the church. Upon arriving at 10 Downing, she told her husband the story. Churchill said, "You ought to have cried, 'Shame! Desecrating the house of God with lies!'" Churchill then traveled to Chartwell, the family home outside London, to work on his first radio broadcast as Prime Minister, and to spend a few peaceful moments beside his pond, feeding his goldfish and a black swan. There had been other swans, but foxes had killed them. A new telephone call from France drew Churchill back to London. The situation was growing dramatically worse, the French army wilting. Despite the grave news, Churchill seemed unfazed, and this caused a further warming in Jock Colville's attitude toward his new employer. In his diary that Sunday, Colville wrote, "Whatever Winston's shortcomings, he seems to be the man for the occasion. His spirit is indomitable, and even if France and England should be lost, I feel he would carry on the crusade himself with a band of privateers. He added, "Perhaps my judgments of him have been harsh, but the situation was very different a few weeks ago." At a 4:30 meeting of his war cabinet, Churchill learned that the commander-in-chief of Britain's forces in France was contemplating a withdrawal toward the Channel coast, identifying in particular the port city of Dunkirk. Churchill opposed the idea. He feared that the force would be trapped and destroyed. Churchill made the decision that, in fact, no fighter aircraft would be sent to France. With that country's fate now seeming so tenuous, there was little point, and every fighter was needed in England to defend against the coming invasion. He worked on his radio speech until the last minute, from 6 to 9 that night, before settling himself in front of a BBC microphone. "I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister, in a solemn hour for the life of our country," he began. He explained how the Germans had broken through the French line using a remarkable combination of aircraft and tanks. However, he said, the French had proven themselves in the past to be adept at raising counter-offensives, and this talent, in tandem with the power and skill of the British Army, could turn the situation around. The speech set a pattern that he would follow throughout the war, offering a sober appraisal of facts, tempered with reason for optimism. "It would be foolish to disguise the gravity of the hour," he said. "It would be still more foolish to lose heart and courage." He left out completely any reference to the possibility discussed just a few hours earlier with his war cabinet, that Britain might withdraw the BEF from France. Next, he addressed his main reason for giving the speech, to warn his countrymen of what lay ahead. "After this battle in France abates its force, there will come the battle for our islands, for all that Britain is and all that Britain means," he said. "In that supreme emergency, we shall not hesitate to take every step, even the most drastic, to call forth from our people the last ounce and inch of effort of which they are capable." The speech terrified some listeners, but Churchill's apparent candor, at least on the threat of invasion, if not the true state of the French army, encouraged others. According to the Home Intelligence Division of the Ministry of Information, the division went to great lengths to monitor public opinion and morale, publishing weekly reports that drew from more than 100 sources, including postal and telephone censors, movie theater managers, and the operators of bookstalls owned by W.H. Smith. After Churchill's broadcast, Home Intelligence conducted a lightning survey of listeners. Of 150 house-to-house interviews in the London area, it reported, approximately half said they were frightened and worried by the speech. The rest were heartened, made more determined, stiffened. Now Churchill turned again to the agonizing decision about what to do with the hundreds of thousands of British soldiers in France. His inclination was to insist that they take the offensive and fight it out. But the time for such heroics seemed to have passed. The British expeditionary force was in full retreat toward the coast, pursued by Germany's armored divisions, which had given Hitler so lethal an advantage in his drive across Europe. The BEF faced the very real prospect of annihilation. The Churchill who on Sunday had struck Colville as being unfazed was here supplanted by a prime minister who seemed deeply worried about the fate of the empire in his charge. Wrote Colville on Tuesday, May 21, "I have not seen Winston so depressed." Churchill resolved, against the advice of his chiefs of staff and others, to fly to Paris for a second meeting, this time in foul weather. The visit achieved nothing except to worry Clementine and daughter Mary. "It was terrible flying weather," Mary wrote in her diary, "and I was so anxious. The news is unbelievably bad. One can only hang on by praying it will come out all right." So tense were things, so high the pressure on all, that members of Churchill's cabinet decided that he ought to have a personal physician, though the patient himself did not agree. The assignment fell to Sir Charles Wilson, Dean of the Medical School at St. Mary's Hospital in London. A medical officer in the prior war, he had been awarded a Military Cross in 1916 for bravery in the Battle of the Somme. Late in the morning, on Friday, May 24, Wilson found himself at Admiralty House, being led upstairs to Churchill's bedroom. In Britain, a doctor of Wilson's stature is typically referred to not by the prefix doctor, but rather as Mr. "I have become his doctor," Wilson wrote in his diary, "not because he wanted one, but because certain members of the cabinet who realized how essential he had become have decided that somebody ought to keep an eye on his health." It was almost noon by now, but as Wilson entered the room, he found Churchill still in bed, seated upright against a bedrest, reading. Churchill did not look up. Wilson walked to his bedside. Churchill still did not acknowledge his presence. He continued to read. After a few moments, what to Wilson seemed quite a long time, Churchill lowered the document and with impatience said, "I don't know why they are making such a fuss. There's nothing wrong with me." He resumed reading, with Wilson still at hand. After another overlong interval, Churchill abruptly shoved away his bedrest, threw off his covers, and barked, "I suffer from dyspepsia," indigestion, or what later generations would call heartburn, "and this is the treatment." He launched into a breathing exercise. Wilson watched. His big white belly was moving up and down, he recalled later, when there was a knock on the door, and the PM grabbed at the sheet as Mrs. Hill came into the room. This was Kathleen Hill, 39, his beloved personal secretary. She and her typewriter were ever present, whether Churchill was clothed or not. "Soon after," Wilson wrote, "I took my leave. I do not like the job, and I do not think the arrangement can last." From John Colville's perspective, Churchill had no need for a doctor's attention. He seemed fit and was once again in good spirits, having shed his depression of several days earlier. Later that Friday, Colville arrived at Admiralty House to find Churchill dressed in the most brilliant of flowery dressing gowns and puffing a long cigar as he ascended from the upper war room to his bedroom. He was about to take one of his daily baths, these prepared with precision, 98 degrees Fahrenheit and 2/3 full, by his valet butler Frank Sawyers, present at all hours, the inevitable egregious Sawyers, as Colville wrote. Churchill took two baths every day, his longtime habit, no matter where he was and regardless of the urgency of the events unfolding elsewhere, whether at the embassy in Paris during one of his meetings with French leaders, or aboard his prime ministerial train, whose lavatory included a bathtub. On this Friday, a number of important telephone calls demanded his attention during his bath hour. With Colville standing by, Churchill took each call, climbing naked from the tub and swathing himself with a towel. Colville found this to be one of Churchill's most endearing traits, his complete absence of personal vanity. Colville witnessed scenes at Admiralty House and 10 Downing Street unlike anything he had encountered while working for Chamberlain. Churchill would wander the halls wearing a red dressing gown, a helmet, and slippers with pom-poms. He was also given to wearing his sky-blue siren suit, a one-piece outfit of his own design that could be pulled on at a moment's notice. His staff called it his rompers. At times, according to his security officer, Inspector Thompson, the outfit made Churchill look so pneumatic as to suggest he might at any moment rise from the floor and sail around over his own acres. Colville was coming to like the man. Churchill's equanimity was all the more remarkable given the news emerging that Friday from across the Channel. To everyone's continued mystification, the great French army now seemed on the verge of final defeat. the one firm rock on which everyone was willing to build for the last 2 years, was the French army, wrote Foreign Secretary Halifax in his diary, and the Germans walked through it like they did through the Poles. That day, too, Churchill received a sobering document that dared contemplate this hitherto unthinkable outcome, still so beyond imagining that the authors of the report, the chiefs of staff, could not bring themselves to mention it in the title, calling their paper British Strategy in a Certain Eventuality.